It's good that innate immunity made its way, because when I started, the T-cell biologists, they dominated the field. And in this way, I think, ignored to some extent the impact of microbiota. I mean, that all is revisited and came then. But I started as an epithelial interested biologist. The epithelium as an interface, inflammation as a consequence, the question, if you have inflammatory activation, is this equal inflammation? No, it's not. It's adaptation.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on metabolic health through the gut. In this series, we speak with experts about how gastrointestinal physiology, including gut microbes, can affect cardiometabolic health and body weight.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest on the Science, Microbes and Health podcast is Dirk Haller. And Dirk is a professor at the Technical University of Munich. And Dirk, the thing I noticed when I looked at your CV is that you're a professor of nutrition and immunology. So to me, that's food and the host. And obviously, everybody knows that food affects the health of the host. But then there's this third player that maybe people aren't as aware of, the microbiome, which is a kind of an intermediate or a translator of diet towards human health. But that's not an instinctive thing for a nutritionist or an immunologist to think about. What was it first that made you start to focus on the microbiome as a potential player in host health?
Well, yeah, thank you, Colin. First of all, thanks for having me here. I think podcasts are a great format, and it's always fun to contribute and join. You know, when I look back more than 25 years, I finished my PhD in 2000. You and many others in those days dealt with microflora, and often we came from the nutrition science environment in those days, with first approaches on probiotics, often coming from animal feed, then moving into human food, and eventually then 2000, slightly starting to crawl into this new era of microbiome. So if you ask me, I'm a studied nutrition scientist, and I studied food science as well with a major in microbiology. So for me, it was always interesting to see what the microbes, especially the commensals in those days, would do to the host and how it would be inferring on health and diseases.
And I know this is a really unfair question, but if we had to ask, you know, the diet influences the host, diet influences the microbiome, and then the microbiome influences the host. But is the influence of the microbiome-mediated dietary impact, is that 10% of, and 90% is just diet? Is it 50-50? Is it 10? I know it's a very unfair question, but
if it's pure speculation, it's just numbers to potentially discuss the weight on one or the other side of the scale, I think. I mean, food per se, nutrition has a clear impact, yeah, and we shouldn't really ignore or discuss that. But we learned that nutrition science came from deficiencies, and we understand very well a lot of nutrient deficiencies, but nowadays that's not the case anymore. It's actually the opposite in most cases. And here I think a complete new dimension comes into this speculative question, and a lot of nutrients increase metabolic changes if absorbed. If not absorbed, it would impact the microbial environment. And food processes, I think this is another issue, where due to processing, absorptive capacities are reduced to some extent. So I think there is clear growing interest that food has a real impact. But I have a little confounder, Colin, because, you know, when you look at literature, if you look at the big population studies at the moment, you know, when they try to explain variance in the data sets, usually diet is in between 1 to 2%, very persistently explaining 1 to 2% variance in the data sets. Yet, if you do intervention trials, and we do some of those, you not obviously see huge shifts very often, but you see fingerprints, signatures. And I think this just started, if you ask me, and we are on this breaking point to define specifically the impact of diets on microbial composition and then later on function.
Dirk, one of the interesting things you've done speaking of the difference between like deficiency and other aspects of diet is characterized circadian rhythms. And so Colin and I have always been interested in like the impact of industrialization. And we've speculated that might have something to do with the amount of live dietary microbes in the diet. But you've done a lot of fascinating work on just the timing, the circadian rhythms that are present in the bacteria. And I wonder if you can kind of talk about the how you got interested in the circadian rhythms. It's relevant, of course, for industrialization because of shift work and the disruptions in patterns due to shift work.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan. I have to admit it jumped into my face and I tried to resist because I was not a real well-trained circadian biologist. And I'm just, you know, the point is that in microbiome research, we have to go into various disciplines. I mean, I would say my core discipline is gastroenterology and the impact of microbe-host interactions in the gut and inflammatory or tumorigenic responses. But the circadian biology is something completely different. And I had a postdoc in my lab, and she was a true circadian believer. And I gave her a fair hard amount of counterintuitive responses. And at the end, I had to admit that there is something, no doubt. And we first saw this in big population data. And there's just a review coming out, just accepted in Cell Host Microbe on that with Christoph Theiss together. And he reported this for the first time in a very, very small amount of people too, actually. And we showed this then in a population study associated with changes due to metabolic diseases. And the problem in circadian biology, I think, in population studies is that you need the samples and you need the distribution of samples over time, over a 24-hour period of time. And that usually means you need huge amounts of samples from individuals to identify a signal. And that was my first surprise, but not, I would say, completely novel. But then seeing that in pre-diabetic conditions or type 2 diabetes as an endpoint, even real predictive in cohorts, which we followed up for additional 5 years, we could potentially predict. And here I have to say this, allow me this, even if it's a little lengthy, I'm apologizing for that. But when we predict, this is population based, and it's not even remotely close to individual prediction. If you do these classification curves and rock analysis, you have areas under the curves, anything between 70% and 80% that excites epidemiologists, but a clinical biochemist couldn't be bored more. And so you identify population stratification and risk. That's cool. But then in this recent intervention trial in babies, we were actually, and that was really exciting, we saw that circadian rhythms establish towards the first year of life, but we could take complex communities out of the host. And after 10 to 14 days out of the host, we still saw these diurnal oscillations independent of host, which would indicate then a real true circadian effect. And this is something we're really interested in, of whether or not clock genes potentially help early life colonization, for example, to adapt. I think would make sense. But yes.
Just one quick follow-up. That clinical trial was terrific. And you showed like four different formula fed, and then your control were the breastfed. There's two things I wanted you to note about that. One is how the GOS had particular impacts, the group that was fed GOS. And then the other thing was just an idea I wanted to get your reaction to. I've heard some of my colleagues that work in donor breast milk discuss the entrainment of circadian rhythms in infants and think it may be important to note the timing of the specimen of the breast milk collection.
You ask circadian biologists, they would say there is a clear circadian biology to immune reactions, morning, night, for example. I think that's relatively clear. I would almost bet everything that breast milk composition is undergoing circadian changes to fulfill functions. Yeah. And I think the real interesting question is whether the bacteria in the gut follow this. So they follow the available nutrients, and that per se has then a circadian dictate from the mother, for example, because that would be logic. And I think it would be fair and good. It does not really explain why you can maintain diurnal rhythmicity ex vivo in continuous fermentation. That would indicate that there is something in a free running phase, that there is something like a circadian clock. We're actually doing experiments where you transfer again from the fermenters into another fermenter, and you see that basically amplitude and circadian behavior kind of dilutes out. So the question is, do you need entrainment? What are the site givers for those? And coming to your Yugo's question, I think the still puzzling point in all of those interventions we did in newborns is there's no doubt that breast milk is the mother nature preferred nutrient at that point of time. There are many reasons to breastfeed. But what we saw is that GOS also induces selective growth. And we know that GOS is a very selective substrate for bifidobacteria. And you would also gain arrhythmic taxa in response to GOS. So there is not a big difference between breast milk and GOS. We followed up with metagenomic analysis at the moment. And I have to say one thing, and that was very interesting to me as well. If you look at strain, and that's off the press, really brand new. If you look at strain assembly and which strains would make it into this system, in the intervention group, the probiotics, or the, we shouldn't call it probiotics because they're not probiotics, they're bifidobacteria. Those strains you feed, they take advantage from this ecosystem and they prevent colonization of other bifidobacterial strains. So there is something with this probiotic intervention and GOS. GOS selects a little broader. Breast milk selects much broader in terms of strain diversity. So big questions are, if we select bifidobacteria for infant feed or for infant food, then the question is, are we really sure that those are the right ones we selected? Because they're going to stick for quite a bit and prevent colonization, for example, from other bifidobacterial longum infantis strains.
Yeah, I think the work in fermenters is just absolutely stunning. And in babies, I love work in babies because a baby will give you a fetal sample more or less day round. And so you can follow things like circadian rhythm. In adults, of course, I would guess that 99% of fecal samples collected for adult studies are collected during the day, not during the night. And therefore, there's going to be different colonic residence times. There's going to be so many confounders in each fecal sample. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the method you use for analyzing the sample, the sequencing tech.
Absolutely.
Like, this is a big confounder, I think, because with diet, we can measure macro and micronutrients and mineral content and things pretty accurately. With a lot of metabolic biomarkers in host health, we can measure a lot of those pretty accurately. How accurate do you think we are? And you talked about strain level accuracy in the microbiome. Do you think that's still a big black box for us to understand?
If I have the numbers correctly in my mind, so 40% of the sequence data when we do metagenomics analysis are still unknown sequences. So we have absolutely no clue what they mean, to what type of taxa they belong. And 70% of the sequence-based data we cannot cultivate. So I think we have to face the fact that we know still not enough or even little. I think there is a fast track towards bringing these sequencing-related data into data banks. And I'm hopeful that in 10 years, maybe, that you narrow this gap. Accuracy, if you work with uncured data banks, there is a certain level of uncertainty. In our hands, at least, if you run it on one and the same platform and one and the same bioinformatic pipeline, it is relatively accurate. You can look at strains. The question is, would that tell you much? Yeah, because we are really equipped by very different strains. And we have seen this in a study we did with pediatric Crohn's disease patients exposed to exclusive enteral nutrition. And some taxa, Bacteroides, for example, they would have almost no fluctuation. Others have basically, during the whole intervention and after intervention, a permanent exchange of strains of the same species. So I would say study-to-study comparison still difficult because we're not 100% aligned in tools. I think we're getting better in the field, but there this always going to be a confounder. And then you have this massive metabolite unknown, yeah, where when you run untargeted, you have mass to charge ratios. And very, I would say the minority are proven metabolites. It's just usually suggestions which make more or less sense related to mass and charge. Yeah, there is. I think we have to live with uncertainty in this field still.
I think, Dirk, even when the methods are the same, you've pointed out because of the diurnal variation that that could mask differences, because if you don't even, and I don't know that in most of our clinical trials or even our observational studies, we're good at collecting the and taking into account in the analysis the timing of the fecal collection. And it's that's really important.
I mean, one of the conclusions from that population study we did 2000 was you cannot do population intervention trials without mentioning the time of defecation and sample collection. Because we sometimes saw at the family level or even phylum level up to 5% abundance changes over a day. And that's massive. And if you just by accident chose two different time points, which have been then in a different circadian condition, that's not a real difference. It's just it's the timing. So I mean, one of the clear suggestions is take the time of defecation. But the reality is, as you say, not many studies did that because we needed a replication cohort. And the biggest problem was not to get a replication cohort, but to have a cohort which had reported times of defecation. Pretty rare still.
And I think that phages as well, I mean, this is my own bias, but bacteriophages can play a role in this, you know, strain replacement and up and down of strains. Of course, you can get blooms of phage. But I wanted to turn to the metabolic aspect of your research. And can you differentiate between how the metabolic health of the host and the metabolic output of gut microorganisms or the microbiome? What's going on there? What's the relationship between microbiome metabolism and host metabolism?
So first of all, I have to say that the primary research we do is not metabolism. I'm touching on metabolism always when we ask questions related to ecosystems and have not enough patients. Yeah, like, for example, if you do a longitudinal prospective cohort on IBD patients, that doesn't really exist, yeah, because there are not enough patients. So often we take advantage to look at metabolic diseases and microbiome relations, because simply for type 2 diabetic or obese people, you have enough numbers in population cohorts. So that's as a little confounder here. But when I look at the metabolic output of bacteria and the metabolic changes in host, I think this equation is not fully solved, is my impression. I mean, the bacteria, no doubt, have a metabolic output. They profit and produce metabolites. They profit from metabolites from the host. I don't think it's so simple to say that's the metabolic output of a microbiota and that's the metabolic condition of the host and this needs to match. I mean, I don't think this is too easy. What we see is that there is a lot of metabolic cooperation. And again, we look in types of diseases like cancer, where we see that the host and host metabolism changes microbial metabolism to live, for example, all of the sudden on medium chain or long chain fatty acids. And those niches are then recreated in a way that the host changes metabolism, microbiota adapts. And that's not just an adaptation, but you have then a progressive element in here, because that adapted microbial environment then drives, at least in IBD and colorectal cancer, in the examples we looked at, drives disease progression. And so that, I think there is a massive metabolic cooperation ongoing between microbiota and host. And the host shapes, no doubtly, the microbial environment. And, you know, from Jeffrey Gordon, we know these bacteria, the Theta Iota Omicron studies 30 years back, where molecular basis for metabolic cooperation comes from the bacterial side as well, with a food causation. So I'm not sure, long story short, of whether you can take one-to-one the metabolic output of bacteria and then say that's the metabolic output then as a consequence of the host. I think there is more cooperation and adaptation.
Dirk, one of your central expertise is immunology. And so it's interesting to me how you've really done all this really interesting work related to metabolism, but you've done a lot of work kind of explaining the connections between immunological response and metabolic outcomes. I wonder if you can take us a little bit on your journey there. I think you started with the immunological aspects and then have gotten into the metabolism, but correct me if I am.
But it's good that innate immunity made its way, because when I started, the T-cell biologists, they dominated the field. And in this way, I think, ignored to some extent the impact of microbiota. I mean, that all is revisited and came then. But I started as an epithelial interested biologist. The epithelium as an interface, inflammation as a consequence, the question, if you have inflammatory activation, is this equal inflammation? No, it's not. It's adaptation. And it took, I think, 20 years to some extent solve the question where toll-like receptors are located. Yeah, and I still remember when the question was, okay, what step I would like to do in my career next after my PhD, and I realized I came from the Nestle Research Center, and I realized probiotics will not explain the world, and I chose to go in an environment where chronic inflammation was the target, and where the first evidence was generated in models that germ-free, recolonized, recapitulates the disease, an inflammatory disease. So this is my background in immunology. So I would say I'm an innate epithelial biologist / immunologist. And that still fascinates me, how this barrier, how communicative it is and how interactive it is, and how many signals are actually integrated at that level. And I think we're still far away in understanding this first hit before then microbes in an antigen-specific way are sampled and processed in an adaptive immune fashion. And that all plays a fundamental role, and especially in chronic inflammation, the adaptive immune part is very important. But the interesting story is that the innate immune system revolutionized chronic inflammatory bowel disease. Yeah, and you know, with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, always believed it to be a T-cell problem, but at the end it was also a barrier problem, and that came relatively late in the scientific development. So it's kind of, we developed first the adaptive immune system and then came to the innate immune system to realize that it's really important for those kind of chronic inflammatory diseases.
Dirk, as we kind of wrap up here, I want to look towards the future. And two of the major metabolic issues facing humanity, I guess, you've already pointed them out, type 2 diabetes, obesity. You know, there are, I'm sure, excellent dietary strategies for both of those conditions, but people find it very hard to adopt and to, you know, adhere to those dietary strategies. And so obesity and type 2 diabetes continues to rise. Do you think there will be approaches of manipulating the microbiome to help to control these metabolic diseases? I mean, GLP-1 agonists are, of course, top of the news and on every newspaper headline.
Yeah.
But do you think microbiome will be a lever that we can use to address these conditions?
I was always a bit a skeptic of this, because when I look at effect sizes, also published effect sizes in the obesity field and translation from mouse studies to human, where in mouse studies, a 2 or 3% weight gain was considered obese. That's by far not obese. I think we had slight problems with effect sizes and terminologies, which made it difficult to conclude or even imagine that you can identify a microbial environment which makes you slim. So personally, I don't think this is anywhere close, actually. I think weight regulation is terribly complex. And yes, there are plenty of studies also with insulin sensitivity in FMT studies where you have a certain level of effect. The question is, would these effect levels be good enough to be translated into a population-based treatment, which I think the GLP-1 receptor agonists, they are. Yeah, so they will roll over this field. And will change the landscape. Interesting going to be how the microbiome, you know, when people don't eat better, but take the GLP-1 receptor agonists, they still eat badly, potentially, what that does to the microbiome and what consequences could be. So I think obesity has a fingerprint in microbial communities, and that avenue I fully believe. I'm a bit more skeptic in the other way around, that by intervention that you reach an effect size which is good enough for treatment. And I see this for inflammatory bowel diseases, you know, with ulcerative colitis, where you have a 20% response rate over placebo, for example, which is fairly good. If you see that other drugs have a 30-40% response rate, and I don't see this in obesity. And I really like that answer because
I think there's almost a pressure on microbiome scientists, if that's a term, to almost to have to say that the microbiome is you know, the most important in almost every disease and every state. And of course, it's not and shouldn't be and never will be. But it is another tool, another weapon, another potential source of biomarkers. You know, it's a way into a disease, but it doesn't have to be the cure-all for every disease in order to be important.
And there is always the possibility, and you see this again in inflammatory diseases and even in cancer treatment, that adjuvant modulation of the microbial environment would trigger response rates of immune checkpoint inhibitors, for example. So there is I think sometimes we're a bit too one-dimensional, which I think is the drug research design in people's head. One drug, one effect size, and the companies are interested in this one drug and are not interested in additional adjuvant effects. So I think there is more room to a more, I would say, individualized treatment scenario. And if you are not the number one effector with a microbiome, it may be still okay in the second or third rank even to deliver changes which modulate potentially other side effects. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And maybe even modulate behavior, you know, through the gut-brain axis and things like that.
Absolutely.
We could talk, I think, for another hour with ease, and we still wouldn't have used up all our questions, but we have run out of time. So listen, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you giving your time and your expertise to this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to just thank you for the terrific experiments you do. They always shed light. You know, you always do these great follow-up experiments and really help lead to discoveries. And we need people like you to, you know, better inform how we should do our intervention research. So keep up the great, great work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. And check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.